just the only extent that anything I'll tell you about or have prepared is new is that I was figuring it out last night. But that's me figuring it out. I mean, this is all standard stuff that's known. And I guess after talking with Jake about what was discussed yesterday, which I was unable to come to the session then, and also hearing about what some of the other people can be talking about today, I thought I would try to focus in on what some of the differences are between the nuclear five-hod state and the Strunz and Ruthven egg, in particular, looking at the edge. And in particular, how close is the analogy to the edge-shaped structure and for the point contact, the tunneling, which is something some of us have thought a lot about in the context of the quantum Hall effect. So the motivation, probably you all know, but is that the proposed wave function for the only even denominator fractional quantum Hall state observed, this is the only one with any sort of strength, is at nuclear 5 halves, and there's a proposal way back now, 1991, by Ray Moore and Nick Reed, that what we're dealing with is some sort of paired quantum Hall state. And so the Moore-Reed wave function consists of two parts. The first part here is EI minus EJ squared, is a Laughlin-like type wave function for bosons in the Hopf-Fields-Lambda level. I mean, let's subtract two conceptually here. One's really up in the first Lambda level. So it's EI minus EJ squared, but the system is made of electrons, of course. And so they multiply this factor by a P plus IP BCS wave function for the spinless, presumed spinless electrons. And in order to get it in the lowest Lambda level, they took this analytic form for the paired wave function, 1 over z. But the symmetry is the same as for BCS state. Okay, so basically, Moore-Reed is Laughlin cross BCS. And sometimes people think in terms of what are called composite fermions. So this ZI minus EJ squared is converting the electrons to what are called composite fermions. And for the nu equals 1/2 state, not 5/2, those composite fermions appear to form some sort of Fermi liquid. This vacuum state can be, the Moore-Reed state can be viewed as those composite fermions undergoing a BCS instability, actually a very strong pairing into this P plus IP state. Okay, so I'm going to skip right through this. The physics of the P plus IP superconductive holds zero Dejean, the eigenstates, plus and minus pairs, spectrum with a gap and a bulk, the edge states, probably most people are familiar with this. The bulk is gap. If you just take a potential which is negative in the system and very large and positive to outside the system to suppress all the electrons here, one finds that there is an edge mode and there's a two-component spinner here which is tangent to the edge. So there's an edge Meyer-Mann fermion. It's chiral. That fermion propagates along the edge in a particular direction, which is determined by whether it's P plus IP or P minus IP. In a droplet, the edge state would encircle the system. Okay, I think I will.
So, is there anything you're going to talk about spindles for the people's like?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to I'm not really going to talk about Strunz and Ruthven egg, but to the extent that I am, I'm going to assume the spin is not causing one any problems, which it is, probably. Right? So I'll assume that it's a D vector lines and.
In the plane and can rotate.
Yeah. So, I don't want to address whether that's legitimate. I'm not an expert on Strunz and Ruthven egg, and perhaps it's relevant there. But that issue is not.
Matt, a related question is: would you say anything about the distinction between edge in something like quantum Hall, where you have some potential being applied by Gates and so on, causing the edge, and real Strunz and Ruthven egg, what edge really means? The bulk just ends.
Yeah, but I think conceptually, in a very broad brush, they're the same. I mean, that system and on Hall effect doesn't exist outside here. I mean, the electron density goes to zero, and of course, in something with my crystal, one will have an edge of the crystal. I mean,
it's a very sharp edge in the language of quantum Hall, right? In this function.
Yeah, I guess, although presumably the width of this, edge mode, which I haven't really talked about the internal wave function here, will be, I guess, set by the coherence length, In the quantum Hall case, actually, it's set by the magnetic length, which is quantum Hall.
You might worry more that, it's all perfect edge. If it was just that it was abrupt, I'd say the mathematics would be, there's really no real difference. But the fact that it's rough could actually cause problems.
Well, okay, the beautiful thing about this particular, the people's IP state, as long as the bulk is gapped, it doesn't matter how rough the edge is. You have to have this chiral Majorana fermion. And if the edge is rough, the chiral fermion just, scoots along the edge. Right. Now, you can have other, in principle, low energy modes, which may be moving in both directions, but you can probably get rid of this chiral state.
Except when you have screening.
What is the relationship?
No, it's nothing to do with screening, because this is actually neutral. It's electrically neutral. In fact, both in the quantum Hall case and in the superconducting.
Well, I guess in that case, probably your edge affects your D vector, I guess, for us, but.
With edge effects go up, sorry?
It probably affects your D vector. I mean, even if you did, it's kind of reasonably, if you could take your D vector into the plane and rotate it, probably the edge could still affect it. But anyways, that's
it. It may not. I think as long as it's.
Like in liquid helium, apparently, the edge really orients the D vector.
Right? My guess is it doesn't matter.
It orients the L vector.
But I think that wouldn't even actually matter. I mean, in what sense? I mean, if the bulk in quantum Ruthenia really has a D vector in the plane, it's locked there, and it can rotate.
Well, what if the edge locked? Yes.
Well, I don't think that. I mean, you still would have to have this chiral edge mode. I mean, it's just you cannot get rid of it. It's dictated by the topological structure of the bulk superconducting state in that case. I could affect the velocity that this thing moves, and as I say, there could, in principle, be additional pairs of Majorana modes which are moving in opposite directions. But those would tend to scatter off one another and localize. You have to get left with one chiral.
Is it turned on?
The beautiful thing is that.
About this is the topological protection.
What is the relationship between this H state and Majorana fermion? You mean that if you solve, for instance, Gödel for Bogolyubov-Dejean equations, we obtain a solution Majorana fermion at the H?
Yeah, exactly what I mean. So it's Bogolyubov-Dejean Hamiltonian. Imagine a very slowly varying potential. If you want to do it sort of more analytically, I mean, it doesn't have to be, but. Very slowly varying potential as you move off the edge. That may be unrealistic, but let me just take it so to make things simple. And then you can basically drop this second derivative term relative to this term here. And so if you just take the Dirac form with a very slowly varying potential, which just depends on one coordinate, the y coordinate here, you can readily see, if you sit down and look at it, that that one will have a bound state, bound to the edge, which can propagate with a momentum down the edge, but the wave function will be bound to that edge. And so here V0 is, it's negative, but y is negative. So the wave function will fall off exponentially away from the edge. And in fact, to understand, I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about this, but I don't really have time. But I mean, to understand the vortices, one can actually You can view a vortex as you basically just knock a hole in the sample. I mean, you know, don't worry about what's going on in the core. I mean, it's important in practice, but, and then, so you have an inner edge, and so you have an inner edge mode, and that's the Majorana fermion that's bound to the vortex. And well, the boundary conditions you have to worry about, and because the vortex, if it's an HC over 2E vortex, you then have periodic boundary conditions on this Majorana fermion, so you have one mode at zero momentum going around the vortex. And I guess that's probably where the D plus I, D, I mean the D wave, the D vector, sorry, the D vector is going to be important. And correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't really thought about this, but I think if you had spin in there, you know, it was an up, up, plus down, down, and that's a D vector along the Z axis, let's say. And I think then you would probably have two modes and they could gap out on one another, I think. So, you'd still, they would have low energy, well, okay, they would be, relative, they would probably be sub-gap. I mean, they, you know, as far as the bulk gap, but they're not going to be. But you would have two, and you know that's very, very crucial in the context of topological quantum computing. In order for these vortices to be very entangled with one another, you need, you know, a conventional electron operator to be kind of split into a Majorana fermion, one which lives on each of these vortices, if you have two of them. And but if you have an electron, if you will, that can live on a single vortex, then you know, all of that interesting, well, this interesting topological physics of the, you know, disappears. Okay, when I talk about a vortex here, but I think, okay.
Actually, I think Mike's going to be on the edges.
Yeah, edges, you can define a vortex up around the edge. Okay, include charge. I mean, the distinction between, well, okay, so the, in the, something ruthenate, if the Z vector could rotate and the nu equals phi half edge, the neutral sector, and this Majorana fermion doesn't carry an electrical charge, it carries a Z2 charge, it's a parity, a fermion parity. These are, you can just say there's an even or odd number of fermions. I mean, actually, it looks like it's probably even the energy scale is going to be roughly the same for these edge modes as far as the, you know, because the superconducting gap. I mean, what's CC is a Kelvin or so?
And the
nu equals phi halves, the bulk gap is, you know, maybe it's half a, it can be half a Kelvin, and the coherence length and the magnetic length, so, hey, that looks all good. But when you put in the charge, things are very different, of course. So in the nu equals phi halves edge, basically the electrons are charged in the magnetic field, so they go around in cyclotron orbits, and so you have these skipping orbits, the electrical charge, along the edge. And so in addition to this Majorana fermion, which doesn't carry any charge, there's a charge-carrying magnetoplasmon. And so that, well, that's the structure, the minimal structure that you have to have on the edge of the nu equals phi halves one whole thing. Actually, I'm suppressing here the nu equals two edge states, which are kind of underlying this. I mean, so this is what it would look like if you have the Reed-Moore state at nu equals one half, because I'm not including outer energy edge modes. And it's interesting. I mean, if you want to think about, you know, tunneling an electron into the edge here of the quantum Hall case, you add the charge to this mode here, so you add the charge of the electron. But in order to add, to make the, since the electron is a fermion, in order to add the Fermi statistics as well, you have to, you know, excite this neutral mode. You have to use one quantum of this neutral mode.
Maybe one point here to emphasize that there is an experimental signature for the neutral mode in the quantum Hall context here, although we all believe it has to be there for reasons you just said. So if somebody has a brilliant idea to see this function with them, then we'll
Yeah. Well, okay, so I think, okay, no, good. So let me come back to that, for that. I mean, that's, you know, there's various suggestions in the quantum Hall effect context about how one might detect the neutral mode. You know, I think they're all pretty challenging. But okay, so in a BCS, in real, a P plus IT, something ruthenate superconductor, you don't have to worry about the actual electrical charge of the electron that you're tunneling in, because charge is not a good quantum number in the superconductor because of the, you know, breaking of the U1 symmetry. In fact, the electrical charge is not a good quantum number because you have, you know, electron plus hole. The only good quantum number is a Z2 quantum number. So you have an even or odd number of electrons. And that you can accommodate just in this Majorana fermion. So you don't have that extra charge mode. But of course, the charge in the superconductor exists in the bulk, and your bulk fluctuations. And let me imagine a thin film superconductor just to you know, to make things a little simple and make it more analogous to the quantum Hall case. Okay, so a 2D film, okay, you have, you know, the phase of the superconductor conjugate to the, you know, the superfat density, Coulomb interactions, you know, if you screened out the Coulomb interaction, somehow you would have a plasmon, I mean, a, you know, linearly dispersing plasmon mode. But in practice, in a superconducting film, due to the Coulomb interaction, you probably have this square root plasma mode. So that's, you know, that's where the physics is. Okay, probing the edge, very briefly. In the strontium ruthenate context, I think one thing to perhaps contemplate, you know, admittedly very difficult, is to look at the thermal transported edge modes. So what would one expect? Well, in both in the P+IP superconductor and in the quantum Hall case, is a quantized thermal Hall conductance. That is, if you heat up the edge, the heat will move preferentially in one direction along the edge. Now, of course, that heat can get out, you know, into the phonons and you know, so eventually you lose that heat. At low temperatures, you may keep it there, actually, I think, quite a while, but, you know, that's something one wants to look at. I think in the quantum Hall context, it will stay there, you know, for some length scales, at least. In any case, assuming the edge, you know, the energy is conserved on the edge, you know, theoretically, then there'll be a Hall thermal conductivity, which is the usual form, this pi squared over 3, and, you know, this would be the Wiedemann-Franz here for electrons in a Fermi liquid. I mean, I guess, you know, if A was 1, at least, per, you know, per fermionic mode, but for the Majorana fermion, A is 1/2, because it's 1/2 of an electron. For the chiral boson, this charge mode, A is equal to 1. So in the non-abelian abelian fraction of quantum Hall case, you have A would be 5/2. This is 7/2. Excuse me. This is the 2 is coming from the Phil Landau level, you know, below, you know, the zero Landau level, if you will. Then from the, you know, half the Landau level, you have 1 for this charge mode and 1/2 for the neutral mode, and you add up to 7/2. Now, for a P+IP superconductor, you would have A would be 1/2 per layer. Okay, so you, I mean, you basically have this sheaf of chiral fermions, you know, going around the, I mean, you would, going around the strontium ruthenate. And actually, even if it wasn't, you would have those edge states, even if, independent of this D vector. I mean, you have probably two modes.
I
mean,
so I guess in your 5/2 state, you don't have to worry about domains because the field has sort of selected out of reality, or what? I mean, what about, you know, domains actually means,
yeah,
you know, that your edges are really around domains.
Well, actually, that's an interesting question you ask. I mean, so recently, Michael Levin and Bert Halperin, and maybe someone else on the paper, and Chaitin, and a couple of former postdocs, well, Shinsei Yu, who's not a former postdoc, I don't know if you're here, basically, and I, you know, realized that there is a particle hole conjugate state to the Reed-Moore state, we'll call it the anti-Pfaffian, which one can think of as P-IP pairing.
Okay.
And then this Majorana fermion moves in the opposite direction.
And are they actually degenerate?
And they, well, in the lowest Landau, if you project into a Landau level and ignore Landau level mixing, then they're exactly degenerate. The system has a particle hole symmetry, and so Landau level mixing, which actually is not really that weak in practice in the quantum Hall context, will determine which of them has lower energy. But as you move through the plateau, the 5/2 plateau, it's not inconceivable that you could have one region where the Pfaffian has low energy, another reason where the anti-Pfaffian. And now if you have impurities, I mean, again, I don't think there's probably any symmetry reason, well, I have to think about that, whether, you know, that would mean that the impurities couple identically to the Pfaffian and the anti-Pfaffian, because I guess because the impurities would break the particle hole symmetry. Mm-hmm. So you could have domains, I think, in the quantum Hall context as well. Now, you know, whether one will have that, and, I mean, actually very recent experiments that were reported on this weekend by Charlie Marcus of tunneling into point contact in the nucleus 5/2, it's a little bit of a stretch, but if you try to fit to the theoretical expectations, the anti-Pfaffian fits better than the Pfaffian. Now, you know, I'm not sure how seriously one should take that at this stage, but...
Well, if you're having any kind of transition between Pfaffian state and anti-Pfaffian state, what kind of experimental
signature would come out of? Well, okay, so one is that in the anti-Pfaffian, this Majorana fermion would actually move in the opposite direction. Okay, so in fact, rather than being 2 plus 3 halves, Jen, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's 2 minus 1 half.
The signature would be entirely on some kind of heat channel and not on any kind of charge channel.
Yeah, it basically would be. Yeah. Now, that seems crazy. I mean, that you could actually measure thermal transport in the quantum holo context. But actually, Jim Eisenstein reported on, I think the first experimental confirmation first experimental measurement, of thermal transport in the quantum holo context. And in the energy case, he's seeing the chiral heat transport, and it's actually moving in one direction, as one would expect. Challenge for the people that actually do superconductors, here they're measuring the thermal heat transport from one layer, equivalent of Stronfield-Ruthenane. So in Stronfield-Ruthenane, what do you have? Many, 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 many layers. Should be a piece of cake, no?
A piece of layer cake.
If you're in cuprates, you can apply in 20 Tesla and still have the condensate. Here, the condensate dies at 700 Gauss. And since kappa xy generally is linear in the field.
No, but this is thermal.
This is spontaneous.
But still.
So zero field. That's zero field. I mean, conceptually, the experiment would be,
it's hard. Is in zero magnetic field, you somehow take the crystal and you heat up spot. I mean, that you may be able to do on like one part of the crystal. Okay, that heat will move in a chiral fashion. Will start moving in one direction. And so that's the thermal. Okay, in other words, that you raise the temperature of the surface and the heat moves in one direction. So that's the analogous to the whole conductance, where you may raise an electrical potential and you get electrical current.
Right, but experimentally you need to discriminate against the much larger diagonal control.
Right. Well, wait a second, of the thermal conductivity,
The Fullerton contribution is huge.
Yeah.
So you need some way generally one uses a magnetic field and pulls on the anti-symmetric part.
Well, depends. A card experiment, but I don't know. Is it a 50 millikelvin experiment? Does the phonon contribution start?
Yeah, you go down to that.
I think when we need to, probably. That's what these guys are doing, the quantum Hall effect. And let me just say what Jim Eisenstein finds.
So 25 millikelvin because of the problem.
He's at 25 millikelvin, and in the integer quantum Hall case, he's finding that basically the heat, goes along for around, 10 microns, 20 microns, something like that, before it gets dissipated. Now, before the energy, the entropy is lost off the edge. Now, whether that goes to bulk phonons or whether it's going to, quasi-localized impurity states in the bulk, some sort of electrical, residual electrical heat transport, is not completely clear. But
Eisenstein's experiment, he sees quantization of kappa.
No, he doesn't see any quantization. He's just measuring the chiral component. He's just trying to see if does the heat preferentially go one direction over the other. Okay, well that's
Matthew.
Yeah, but that would be would be interesting.
I mean, I don't understand from the point of view of trying to do an experiment. When you call it quantized thermal Hall conductance, but in a way. It's not like a real hole. You put a field in one direction and you measure transfers. I mean, here, basically, what I understand is you're gonna, for example, hit at a spot on the surface, and measure at any opposite direction, you're gonna find something.
Yeah, but it really is the thermal analog of the electrical Hall conductivity. I mean, there'll be a thermal. Because time reversal invariance is presumed to be broken spontaneously, the thermal conductivity, it will be, it'll be a matrix, 2x2 matrix, and it'll be an off-diagonal piece, called kappa xy. And so to make the analogy more precise or more intuitive, perhaps, take a quantum Hall bar, right? And so in the quantum Hall context, you can either, you put a current down and the chemical potential of the edges you know, changes. But think the other way around. You know, put the raise the electrical potential, electrochemical potential on one edge relative to the other, and you get more current flowing down.
Right.
And equivalently, you could. So what you would want to do is raise the temperature, heat one edge over the other, and then you get a net heat propagation. Yeah.
Maybe the confusion is that the word "whole" here is not particularly germane.
That's exactly why.
How is germane? I mean, look, you're running a heat current this way, you're measuring a temperature gradient this way.
Experimentally, it's not a Hall effect, first one, second one. They don't have that by a magnetic field. Calling it Hall conduction is extremely
Okay.
Here, you get the Hall automatically because time reversal invariance is broken. So that's.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry about that. I mean,
It's really the Duke Ricci
coefficient. And I can't remember. I can't pronounce those names, and I can't remember them either. I guess I will apologize that it's being confusing. But I mean, I'm. Yeah. Okay.
Point taken. Problem seeing it. Nice.
Okay. It's off-diagonal component of the Hall conductivity tensor, as you mentioned. Maybe that's what it is. Conductance, the whole conductance, not conductivity. Thermal.
Thermal conductance.
And I just want to say that, I mean, in the superconductor, presumably at very low temperatures, you know, the condensate does not carry heat, right? I mean, that's. Okay, and so the bulk contribution of the electrons, you know, in the because they're paired and you have a gap, freezes out.
But the phonons
freeze out as you go to low enough temperatures. Now again, it's a quantitative issue, which you know one could think about theoretically. I mean, I don't know if people have.
Wait, for the P with W notes.
No, okay, so this is P plus IP. You need a break.
Time reversal invariance gap.
Yeah, the assumption here is it's completely gapped, there's no nodes, and it breaks time reversal invariance. And okay, so if you have the issue, okay, let's say you have domains, I mean, then it's actually quite interesting. I mean, so let's say there are domains all over, then you have internal Majorana fermions running around, and you get bulk thermal transport. And that may not be that insignificant. I mean, if you have domains down on the scale of the coherence length, I mean, well, you can't be too much smaller than that, but I mean, you know, 10 coherence lengths or something, you can view it as having internal, you know, surface sheets of, you know, neutral heat flowing around, and you know, and then I think you will get, okay, then it will be bulk thermal conductance.
Yeah, although the direction, you know, it's a little bit tricky, right? Because it's you get canceling currents.
Yeah, but it doesn't. But I think
it depends on the transition you're on, right? I mean, the sign will change depending on.
Well, okay. I guess if the domain sort of percolate in some sense, I mean, so that you have as many, you know, of the people size IP, or the boundaries between them reach from one side to the other. I mean, that's, you know, granted if they don't, if you have small isolated domains of P minus IP embedded in people's IP, you know, internal in the system, that's not going to help you very much. Mm-hmm. But I guess in Dale Van Harlingen's experiments, it looks like there's domains on the surface. Now, okay, that doesn't necessarily imply that those percolate through, but okay, I mean,
that's allowed us to go on and finish it.
Yeah, so I'll finish up. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, but I think in a way, this, you know, experimentally, this is, I think, something really, you know, worth thinking about. I mean, you know, in Schwarzenbuchner context. And again, in Schwarzenbuchner, if it's P plus IP, independent of this D vector issue and the spin, you would have thermal off-diagonal component of the thermal hole, a thermal tensor. I don't know, thermal linear response tensor. I don't know what it's. We'll call that conductance tensor. Okay, very briefly then, in the quantum Hall context, one of the beautiful suggestions by Jayton et al. And Bert Halpern at CERN, et al., that's Michael Friedman, some of you might know him. And Sankar, I guess some of you, all of you have heard him in any case. I'm sorry. But anyway, it's a very beautiful suggestion, sort of about trying to use point contacts. Tunneling and multiple point contact tunneling, at least two, maybe more, to try to detect qubits, which are entangled between different vortices. So the idea is you pin maybe one vortex here, maybe a number of vortices here. And crucial for this experiment, at least as proposed, is seeing electrical interference. That is, so you're basically sending an electrical current here, and so some of that electrical current will tunnel here, and some of it will tunnel here. And depending on the quantum state of this qubit, the qubit of this vortex and another, that you can have either destructive or constructive interference. And so the electrical, basically the longitudinal conductance of the whole bar, which one measure, that's the easiest thing to measure in a sense, in principle would allow one to detect the presence of such these non-abelian vortices, if you will. Okay, so the question is, can this occur? Could you use something similar in self-enruthenate? You have to think, what you'd be doing with a film and doing it on the surface. But actually, there's a bigger conceptual problem, because the bottom line on this is I don't think this will work in a superconductor. So let me imagine a point contact. Okay, so in the quantum hole, you make that with pinching off the with a gate here. That you can certainly do, and you can make a Josephson point contact in self-enruthenate. In principle, okay, certainly in superconductors. So I'm imagining this is pretty small. Let's to make it analogous here. And you can tunnel, in principle, both electrons and Cooper pairs. And indeed, you can tunnel here both electrons and Cooper pairs. And you can work out what the electrical tunneling conductance is. So in the quantum Hall context, if you expand in T sub E, which is the tunneling rate of an electron, from this edge to that edge, you get the conductance actually vanishes at low temperatures of T to the fourth, predicted to. And if you look at the contribution from Cooper pairs tunneling, it vanishes at a very large pile of temperature. And so, this one would presumably dominate. Let's look at the the people side. Imagine your people side the superconductors on either side, and look at the Josephson and electric tunneling. Well, because of these Andrea bound states, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that the contribution to the tunneling thermal conductance, tunneling electrical conductance from single electrons tunneling will be go to a finite constant as you go to zero temperature. You're basically tunneling into these chiral Majorana fermion edge modes, and there's a constant density of states for adding a Majorana fermion. So that's good, perhaps. But what's not good is that the Cooper pairs tunnel very, very easily. And in fact, now this hasn't even been looked at very carefully. And I can advertise a paper by my former student Mike Kermlin, Gail Raphael, and Paul Goldbart, where we kind of looked at this problem: a point contact in two-dimensional. Josephson point contact in two-dimensional superconductor. Now, what does actual conductance look like as a function of temperature? And so if the T2E, this square, T2E is basically the Josephson coupling constant, the amplitude for tunneling a superpair from one side to the other. Okay, we just did perturbation theory, assuming the superconductors are two-dimensional. Okay, and you have some time integral, and you can see that this time integral actually is divergent at low temperatures. For temperatures below some characteristic temperature, which is basically set by the two-dimensional superfluid stiffness in units of energy. Perhaps this is not surprising. It's very easy to tunnel Cooper pairs across here. But this temperature is below the Kossuth-Salis the transition temperature. This is the final, essentially. So let's look at the other limit of, in the superconductor, which is perhaps more natural, which is phase slip events, HG over 2E vortices tunneling across here. And that's what, in fact, is being used in the quantum Hall context, is essentially an HG over 2E vortex tunneling weakly from one edge to the other. There, the a resistance, longitudinal resistance, which is small when the vortex tunneling is small, in the quantum Hall context, actually, in this case, this is the one that is diverges as you go to this below temperatures, the resistance. And in the superconductor, and this is, you know, actually, I think, a new result, which wasn't around, was in a two-dimensional superconductor, the vortex hopping resistance takes a quasi-activated form with the activation energy itself varying logarithmically with temperature. So basically, this is bad news because for this particular interference type experiment, because essentially in the quantum Hall context, these tunneling vortices, these non-abelian quasi-particles, are very quantum mechanical objects. Whereas in a superconductor, the vortices are essentially classical objects. Because of the phase stiffness in the superconductor. I mean, and one can see that, and this is it. So, and this is again the sort of advertising, you know, this set of results in this paper. You can look at the dimensionality dependence of a point contact Jonassohn effect in a one-dimensional superconductor, and it's a power law. The resistance goes to zero is a power law. G here is proportional to the, you know, which will be huge in practice, is the number of transverse channels in your superconducting wire. So that's just going to be enormous. And in two dimensions, you get this nearly activated resistance. In three dimensions, strictly speaking, although sometimes this is not seen, for any temperature below the transition temperature in the bulk two-dimensional superconductor, the point contact tunneling resistance, even through an arbitrarily small point contact, should be precisely zero in linear response. I mean, actually, this is often not seen, and so you know, I'm not quite sure. You often see some sort of finite leakage resistance or whatever it is. There we go. Yeah.
We will certainly take questions. So, Matthew, what do you think of the suggestion that Nayok et al. Made in another paper, the Sharma Nayok Tewari paper, where Swansea Bhutan agreed said that Nernst effect, just if you take a hub vortex, you know, never mind that it can be done or not, but in principle, certainly we can think of a situation, you take one of these hub vortices and take an FMT and braid it around another one. And then you should see, you know, they will carry some entropy, so there should be a thermal Nernst effect. And one should see differences. But how one measures it and so on are, and if you take an expectation for the braiding operator, one should see.
Yeah, okay, so, yeah. So
that should still be valid, right?
Yeah, no, I think the braiding way of doing topological quantum computing with these non-abelian quasi-particles, one's, you know, grabbing the vortex and moving it around, and so its center of mass motion is classical, and it doesn't matter. Okay, so in principle, and you know, from Ruthenate, the d vector's in the plane, and I mean, you have to worry about many, many layers, and what have you. But just conceptually, just take a single layer, or you know, if they really are pancake vortices, and you know, I don't, you know, then I think, yeah, I mean, then I think that would. Still work. So it's basically, in the quantum Hall context, any experiment, I think, in which involves the vortices behaving quantum mechanically is not going to, you know, be relevant or it doesn't transfer over to the, you know, to the case of the superconductor.
Vortex positions.
The vortex positions behaving quantum mechanically, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, which is something. I mean, if you really weaken a superconductor a lot, actually, you can get that. I mean, if, you know, Aaron's experiments. So, you know, films, you know, Lagrangian magnetic field. It is the vortices start moving around and probably quantum mechanically at some point.
So if vortices, of course, in superconductors are basically classical objects. Is this, the fact that they are classical as opposed to quantum Hall, they're quantum, is this detrimental for quantum computation?
Well, as I say, if you try to use this interference type experiment on the edge states, yes. But if you want to actually braid the vortices around,
that's
no.
Okay.
So these are two separate issues. Uh-huh. You know, the proposal we made in our paper is not anything to do with edge. It's really grab a vortex. First, make it half vortex stable, which is a very big if. By a time field, and probably cannot be done. Mm-hmm. Okay, but if you can do that, then grab a half vortex and braid it around another one, and then look for quantum interference in Nernst effect, which we could not calculate the magnitude, right, Chetan? I mean, we tried, but failed. Yeah. Because it's...
Okay. Just, you know, but maybe I think the point, you know, quantum interference probably isn't something you should look for, but maybe you should try to, you know, observe the quantum state of a pair of vortices by some other way, such as measuring the force between two vortices or something like that. Because, you know, the message here seems to be using an interferometer, probably not such a good
idea. Yeah, no, I don't want to be too negative. It's just like, we're talking about energies, and that's,
But there is another point, and, you know, maybe this touches on what Mike was going to talk about. Talk. When you bring two vortices together, there are two fusion channels corresponding to presence or absence of this fermion. That would lead to some energy difference in, you know, in the force between them or something like that, and that might be a better way of measuring.
Or do the tunneling measurement.
The tunneling
was another experiment that you talked about yesterday, but I do agree with Matthew that eight-channel interference law is not going to go wrong.
So do I understand correctly that in this, in two dimensions, this nearly activated form comes from just the plasmon dispersion, that it is, you know, that it is not gapped?
Well, it comes from actually the hydrodynamic modes below the Koslitz Allos transition temperature. The fact that you don't have off-dying long-range order, but you have Powell law correlations in the pair field in two dimensions, but it's actually a thermal effect. I mean, it's not those modes, you know, can be behaving thermally. And in fact, so when you tunnel an electron in these films, I mean, Cooper pair, I mean, in this Josen point contact, you know, you will excite these thermal, you know, essentially hydrodynamic modes. I mean, at least thermally, and whether they may not equilibrate, but it's, you know, they're thermal. And
So
the vortex backscattering is kind of a quantum tunneling event. So it's a quantum tunneling event being addressed by these thermal phase fluctuations.
So a real material is quasi-two-dimensional. So if I make a point contact between these two quasi-two-dimensional, you know,
two-dimensional films,
what would be the prediction for?
Well, okay, we've worked all that out in gore detail, and you know, you could think about, I mean, some of the experiments done in Illinois with, you know, these superconducting films, maybe, you know, 100 angstroms thick, maybe a little thicker, with you know, carbon nanotube, coated carbon nanotube making a point contact. That looks like a point, pretty much. And so there will be regimes where this behavior, you know, is in principle observable. I mean, you have to worry about how big the system is and so forth, you know, because things travel very quickly in superconductors. I mean, we thought a lot about that. I mean, how big do the films have to be so that, you know, over what temperature range would you see the effects of these, you know, these shake-offs before they actually realize the system's finite, or that your bulk three-dimensional superconducting leads, you know, coming into the hook onto the film, which you would have. And I actually think this is kind of a, you know, as an aside, very much so, as a, you know, the superconducting game is, you know, it's not uninteresting, but it's, you know, it has to be.
But there are no films yet of Stoneson bosonic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this physics is nothing to do with, you know, this is Josen junction physics, which is, you know, sitting around 40 years later, which amazingly wasn't looked at theoretically. I mean, and, you know.
I have a lot of questions, but ask one of them. Ask one of them.
So, you know, keep going back to kappa xy, but if you take the bar geometry, pass a thermal current and measure the transverse gradient drop, right? That pass a thermal current, and so that would be the direct analog of the ordinary quantum law, right?
Yeah, but you really want to, I mean, probably. Okay, I mean, how you actually do that, you have to, okay, yeah.
So
okay, you can think
the big problem for experimentalists is the misalignment. You cannot distinguish any transverse gradient that you see if you have a tiny misalignment. Right? Mm-hmm. So I thought, then, well, why not go to a corbino disk? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't help either, because now you have an edge current running around the peripheral.
Heat. Yeah.
And so, but that creates a very interesting situation. So now you're at 20 millikelvin, assuming no quasi particles, no phonon contribution. So kappa xx would be rigorously zero. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, kappa xx. I think in the superconductor, you know, temperature is way below. Well, okay, the phonons. Yeah. I mean, the electrical contribution.
Let's see further.
Let's see further.
No quasi particles, so no kappa xx.
Yeah.
So a Corbino disk, I heat the center.
Because we don't.
Just because you cut a hole in the sample, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
you can also pump heat.
Yeah, you can pump heat in the center.
So the thermal current swirls around because the alpha x y is fine.
Yeah.
But now in this interesting situation, all you have is a chiral current running around the boundary. What does that do to experiment? So that doesn't.
Well, no, okay. I don't know. I mean, it would be fun to think about this offline a little bit more, but, you know, these are tough experiments, but somehow, if heating one side of the sample, not the other, you know, giving it a burst of energy and looking for some, you know, basically it would be, you know, one has to think about it, but it would probably end up with a thermal gradient down the bar.
Okay. Maybe you're not doing context,
but okay. I mean, harder would be to detect, the actual direction of the propagation. Now I say hard, although that's what Jim Eisenstein has done. You know, I mean, he uses but you can bring in point contacts, and he uses thermoelectric effects in these point contacts to put in some heat and measure the heat over here. I mean, it's hard, but maybe not impossible. You know, and certainly worth thinking about. I mean, because it's
we'll come back to some of the issues Matthew raised toward the end of this session, because I think Mike will talk about not identical but vortices and heat.
No, I mean, that's right, but maybe not completely, partly around.
Well, you're in
helium 4, certainly. I mean, they.
Right. You have some comments or
questions?
You want to say that to everyone? You just want to say, well, I don't know. I'd like to answer the question.
Okay, so Mike Stone will continue his question about exotic physics. I think he's talking about edges and vortices. That's all I know.
Right.
I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago, and Aaron was the chairman, and he let me run on too long, but eventually he had to cut me off. I was going to start and back. Stopped. Hang on, I have to find it. So,
is assume that we've managed to make one of these half quantum vortices. All right. So this is my picture of a half quantum vortex here. So I mean, basically the way to think about it is that we've got spin up and spin down electrons, and the vortex is only in one of those two spin components. And so I'm just going to forget about the other spin component. So this is going to look just like an ordinary vortex, except that it's p-wave and spinless. So what we want to understand is, why is there a special state at E equals zero in such a vortex, and why does it have something to do with quantum computation? That's what I'm going to talk about. So everything I'm going to say is really pretty standard, I think. So it's really just a review of this issue. So let's just start understanding the ordinary Karoly-Gajan-Matricon bound space in a vortex core. So here's my model of a vortex. I've got some region out here with a gap, and I've got a region in here which doesn't have any gap, and what I'm about to say doesn't really, for the moment, depend on a system being p-wave or not. So what happens is, you imagine that you've got an electron, say, in this region, and it's got energy below the gap, so it's free to propagate in here, but it can't get out. And so it undergoes Andre reflection, which, roughly speaking, is going to reflect you back as a whole, it's back along the track where you came from. And so you, Aaron, this is for you. Great. Last time you heard me talk, I had to stop somewhere. I'm starting at exactly that spot. All right. Okay, so the thing comes back as a whole and bounces back and forth, and you can mimic this by a one-dimensional Dirac equation. And the crucial thing is, what is the phase difference of the order parameter between the two ends here? If you're bouncing back and forth across a chord of this circle down here, you're basically seeing the same phase at the two ends, and if you solve that Dirac equation, you find that you've got a state whose energy is close to the edge of the gap. It's not zero energy. But if you bounce across the middle here, you've got a 180-degree phase shift between the order parameter here, because it's winding through 360 degrees as you go around. And then you'll discover, if you solve your Dirac equation, one-dimensional Dirac equation, that you've got a state that's close to zero energy. And you can relate that phase difference then to the amount by which you miss the middle, B, and that impact parameter B, when multiplied by the Fermi energy, gives you some angular momentum. And so you've got an energy that depends on the angular momentum and some frequency here, and some offset, which we're going to have to talk about, which is the big thing that's the difference between the P wave and the S wave. Now, that involves solving a differential equation. You can also understand this from a purely semi-classical argument, which will allow us to work out what that frequency omega is. And here again, what happens is you've got the electron comes along, it's going to meet the condensate. It disappears in Andre reflection into the condensate. But it's got to produce a Cooper pair who's got this associated velocity here. And so when the electron grabs an electron to form such a pair, it leaves a hole which has a momentum such that the sum of the two has to give you this non-zero momentum. It won't come back in exactly the same direction. As a consequence, this guy comes back over, let's go, he comes here, bounces back at an angle, bounces back, and this chord by which you're bouncing back and forth gradually processes around at some frequency, which is actually related to the frequency at which the particle would be orbiting around here. And that allows you to figure out what the omega is, because the angular momentum L and the angle theta are a pair of complementary variables. They satisfy an uncertainty rule, and so the amount by which theta changes is given by dE dL, just like velocity is dE dK. And so the frequency by which this guy creeps back is this one here. And notice the superconductor is going this way, this guy's creeping back in the opposite direction, and there's a minus sign in front of that. The same thing happens with the edge states. You've got a group of pairs are kind of orbiting this way, the edge states creep along in the opposite direction. That doesn't tell us what this offset is, because you just got the derivative, the omega, the L has got to be this frequency, that which is determined purely by geometry. But I should say, if you actually solve the differential equation, you get the same answer, because the picture I've got here is what's happening in the Andreev approximation to the BVG equation. So you've got this alpha. All right, what is alpha? So there's two possibilities. Whenever you solve a Bogdanov-Dejean equation, you always find, you can hardly see it here, that there's, for any solution with eigenvalue E, there's another one with minus E, where you just interchange the two components of the equation and complex conjugate them. And so the spectrum, if I've got to say here, has got to have one down there. And there's basically two cases that you can have. One in which you have an odd guy left at the origin, and one where you don't have one at the origin. And if you solve this for the S-wave case, the original Carolli-Dejean matricon case, you find that this offset, this angle, this offset alpha is a half, and this is the picture you've got. You don't have something exactly at zero. You have something that's spaced here. The spacing here is by this frequency omega. But if you do this for a P-wave case, at least for the simplest model, cylindrical Fermi surface, and so on, you do find exactly a state here. And although that's done in a simple approximation, you know that it's going to be stable because you can't go continuously from this situation to that one. So there's a difference between the P-wave case and the S-wave case. And so in particular, if you have a cylindrical Fermi surface, which isn't really cylindrical, but it has these deep nodes in the gap that we suspect may occur in the ruthenite, so you should still have this picture here.
What happens with D plus ID?
Yeah, well, in D plus ID, you don't have that picture at all because, oh, sorry, D plus ID. Oh, I don't know what happens with D plus ID. I imagine it's like the S-wave case. I haven't solved that before.
You have two of them, basically, so it's not stable.
Okay.
So
that would generate
zero.
Yeah,
because
it's okay,
where are
you
doing that?
I think so.
Equals
I need to be just like S-wave.
No, there's
zero. It should be like S-wave.
Okay.
I'll figure it out later. That's kind of amusing. I didn't do that. Okay, so that's the consequence of having a zero, this mid-gap state, which crops up when you look at what you've got. When you solve your DDG equation, you end up with a two-component spinner, and you're supposed to be expanding out the operator, the electron operator, and psi dagger. These are the things that go into the DDG Hamiltonian, in terms of this, with some operator coefficients times the eigenvalue. So here I'm just looking at these bound states, so the other states of pull. And we know from that e to minus e that if you interchange these two in complex conjugates, you're flipping over to the other guy. And because this is psi and this is psi dagger, that imposes some conditions on these b's. So you can write them out. I've just chosen to look at the L mode and the minus L mode here. There's all the different L's. Here with the psi dagger using this result, but you can also, of course, take the dagger of this one and get daggers down here and get this form. And so as a consequence, there must be a relationship between the BLs and the B of minus Ls. Such a B of L is the same as B dagger of minus L. Now, this doesn't happen for the S-wave case because these guys will have another little label on them, being spin up or spin down. Here, there's no spin, so you've just got this result. And what it means is that annihilating a state which is has some negative L, for example, is exactly the same as creating one with the other L. So you've got this ladder of states. And all the punch a hole down there, that's distinguishable for putting something up here. Here it's not. So the particle is identical to its own antiparticle, and that's what we mean by the thing being Majorana. Sometimes people give me the impression that it's only the L equals zero mode which is Majorana, but the whole thing is a typical of a Majorana particle. It's something that you can't tell the difference between its particle and its antiparticle. But it has a special feature that when I put L equals to zero, because this operator is its own dagger, and so now it doesn't know whether it's an annihilation operator or a creation operator. Normally you think of A as annihilating something and A dagger as creating something and occupying a state. Here you don't have that option. And from the completeness relation, you can also work out that up to a scale, this guy has to square to be 1. Oh, where it's actually normalized. But by renormalizing it, calling it gamma, you end up something that obeys the algebra that was originally invented by Mr. Clifford, rediscovered by Dirac. So you have these things. So this is the Euclidean gamma matrix algebra. So this is what these operators have to do. Now, how can we make states that we can occupy or not occupy? We want to get things which have the algebra of creation and annihilation operators. And this is something that basically was worked out by Dirac, I guess, and probably by Clifford, but I don't know, have not read that paper. So what you can do is you can kind of arbitrarily choose an I and a J and decide to put them together. And so I've chosen here to break them into I and I percent. You put one with gamma and plus I, another one with minus it, call one A and A dagger, and now you've got some operators that obey the fermion annihilation and creation algebra. Your choice is arbitrary how you do this. It's like choosing a complex structure on a vector space. And in particular, you don't really know which one of these should be A and which one should be
A.
Oh, sorry, you've got two N guys. I suppose I went perhaps too fast. Yeah, N is the number, 2N is the number of vortices, I guess. It's just some rule. I want to have an even number of them. And actually what happens if you have a single vortex, you get an extra zero mode on the edge, which is I think what Matthew was saying. You change the spectrum of the edge states when you do that. So you make this arbitrary choice as to how you put them together. And you don't really, for the moment, know which one is A and which one's A dagger, because the algebra is rather symmetric under that. Okay. But nonetheless, you know that you can, now if you've got 2n of these vortices, you've got n a's and n a daggers, and so you can, however many vortices you've got 2 to the n, you can apply any of the a daggers or not apply them, so you get 2 to the number of a daggers as the dimension of your vector space. Actually, one should divide that by 2 because none of the operations we can do change the number of particles from odd to even. And so the actual dimension of the available Hilbert space is 2 to the number of vortices divided by 2. And so what happens is that this is what we should really be drawing the spectrum, that the guys down here are really copies of the ones up there. We can occupy these states and not occupy them. This one I've drawn dashed because really you need two vortices to have something that you can occupy or not occupy. If you've got a bunch of vortices, you just choose this one and this one. I'll have to make a state that I can either occupy or not occupy associated with it. And so the total degeneracy depends on the number of vortices to some smaller power than you would expect if you just had a state associated with each one that you could occupy or not occupy. In that case, you'd have 2 to the number of vortices as opposed to 2 to the number of vortices over 2. It was yesterday somebody said that there's root 2 the number of states. So, yeah, the vortex. Now, when people talk about the quantum computing, and the connection with the Hall effect, they often talk about these algebra of fusion rules, which is something that occurs in conformal field theory, where you imagine that you've got an operator and another operator, and you imagine, ask yourself, what happens when I bring two of these operators together? And the Ising model in that system has a fusion algebra where it has some operators phi times phi, which you can bring them together, and the only thing you get is the identity operator. It also has some things which are basically the spin operators there, which can give you an I plus a psi, or you can combine the spin operator with the Majorana fermion. The two-dimensional Ising model is basically a theory of pre-Majorana fermion. And so you get this rather abstruse algebra. And in the conformal field theory language, the way you're thinking about it really is combining representations of objects, where the sigma is like a spin half thing, and a half plus a half gives you 0 plus 1, or you can add here 1 cross 1 gives you 0. It's not there, there should be a 1 and a 2, but it turns out that the rules for combining these are not quite the same as the ordinary rules, and you have to throw two of them away. But you get this algebra. And you get the same thing in the quantum Hall 5 half state, where these sigmas represent the E over 4 vortices. But what I'm claiming is that you also get exactly the same things here in the T plus IP superconductor. You think of the psi as being the quasi-particles, and if you've got two quasi-particles, they can disappear into the vacuum. If you've got, this one just follows from the other two, actually, by associativity. But the interesting thing is that if you've got two vortices, and you kind of combine them together, you can either get nothing or you can have a quasar particle. And what I want to show you is how that comes about in the superconducting thing. So let's imagine that we've got two vortices. Here I've taken a vortex and an anti-vortex. So if it was only the winding number, I could combine them and they could disappear. And I've got one of these zero energy states in here and one in here, but of course they can tunnel between one another, and presumably the energy of that zero state gets split, just like in polyacetylene, you've got a zero gap state in the kink. You bring two of them together, they you get two not quite zero states. And you can worry about trying to calculate the phases of this thing here, but the tunneling effective thing, which relates only to these zero states, has to be Hermitian, and there's basically only one Hermitian operator that you can write down. I think Addy yesterday said it was gamma 1, gamma 2. I've just written that in a more complicated looking fashion because I like this particular combination because it's a generator of a rotation. So there's this splitting guy, and the splitting thing has to be real for this to be Hermitian, but it could be plus or minus. And it's that plus or minus, really, that detects whether these gammas are to be regarded as annihilation or the combinations to be annihilation or creation operators. If you flip the sign of one of the gammas, or you flip the sign of E, you turn the gamma 1 plus I gamma 2 effectively into gamma 1 minus I gamma 2 and change the role of the two things. So you can imagine now what we've got. We've got this ladder of states here. We've got these two vortices with opposite winding numbers. We try to bring them together. The states start to split. And this is really one state that can be occupied or not occupied, whereas these other ones, this can be occupied or not occupied, or this can be occupied or not occupied. But here you need the two of them before you can say whether it's occupied or not occupied. And so you've got, when they merge, you've got this state here which can be occupied or not occupied. And as you bring them closer together, you know, occupied there, you bring them up to the top, the guys disappear, and you've got a quasi-particle left over. And so that will happen if this state was occupied, you'll get something left over, that's the psi, because this is the quasi-particle that's called psi, and if it turned out that guy was unoccupied, then there's nothing left over. And so you have this choice, use two guys, you either get one or you get something. which is nice. It's much easier to understand in this context than it is, I assure you, when trying to understand the definition of a chiral vertex. Yes, right, okay. So I was just going to say, now, what happens if you look at these things, with mutually moving them around one another, when you put a phase in the order ground, you have to take a square root here. This has to be the complex function, but you have to take a square root. There's a branch depth associated with each one of these. And as Ali said, if you interchange a couple of them, you have some non-trivial operation on these gammas, which has the effect of changing the occupation numbers. If you have these guys here, two of them are vortex and anti-vortex. It's unoccupied, and I take another vortex and go around it. I flip the gamma in here and turn this into an occupied one. So I'm manipulating this 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional state by doing braiding operation. And the one thing you do need to check, which is something that both Sakbam and I and Adi Stern and his collaborators worried about, you need to make sure that there's no additional non-abelian Berry phases. You've got lots of degenerate states here, and usually if you manipulate lots of zero states, they can roll over into one another from Berry phase effects. But it's actually possible to write down the BDG wave functions and check that there is no such thing. And so the explicit effect that you get, which is due to Ivanov, I didn't say, I've never seen him at one of these conferences. He had this brilliant idea. This monodromy, this explicit effect, is exactly what you'll get from braiding. And so the maneuvering these things around allows you to manipulate that.
Sorry, Pete, you're a good-ass person. You said that there's no... I think what you said in words is a little different than what you have written down. You said there was no additional Berry transport, but I think what you said verbally is that there's no additional non-abelian.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. No, there's certainly an abelian phase that multiplies the whole wave function, and that's the thing that represents the Magnus force.
That has to be pi. Well, no, there has to be a pi over a coming out of this also.
Okay.
You know, which write these exponents that are associated with the Ising model.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, the Magnus force is. You know, that's
not overall.
I don't know if I call that Berry phase. Particularly, right? I mean, you're talking about some kind of effective gapless excitation, something like, you know, the phase fluctuation? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I was thinking, well, if you just take two ordinary S wave vortices and move one around the other, then, or just move it around.
Move it around. That is just an area effect, right?
Yeah, the area is an area. Right. You get an effect.
Right. But that's the ordinary Berry. Yeah, that's kind of the ordinary. Yeah. But there also should be some statistical thing that's sensitive to the fact that you've.
Fractional statistics, but it's not manipulating this internal
correct
space.
And there is a thing that has to come out, which is determined, right?
Yes, because it's effectively like the fractional charged object. So it's like it's like in the quantum Hall system. When you try to move a vortex there, you get an area effect because it's electrically charged, but you also get the fractional statistics. But it's not a non-abelian statistic.
Correct. Does that piece come out of your calculation?
Actually, I've forgotten. I don't remember. I don't remember seeing that. That's an interesting question.
We do have it, but I mean, it's like we cannot really calculate it. So we just say it's simple, all stage, we cannot calculate it.
Well, it's just taking one around. I have to think about that. I don't know. Okay, so what I was going to say is even if strontium arrhythmic doesn't turn out to be this, and I suppressed a whole bunch of things to do with the layers and so on, I was pretending I had a single layer, for example, it provides a very nice way of thinking about these things as a discipline, even if the experiments don't work out, which I quite like, but it would be very nice to actually have one of these things and be able to do such stuff. And in particular, it allows us to understand these rules. It's easy to calculate the monogamy, so we might get it, and we can check that there's no additional monogamy. These are the kind of standard references here.
Since the session is topological quantum computation, let me just ask a quick question. So even if all these things happen, this thing is not a quantum computer because it's not dense, as you know, I mean, right? So just as a five-habism, well, this is great. Is there what we would call V-Drzai analog for any kind of superconductor? I mean, not in real life, but can you think of one?
No, it's a question that I would like to answer.
Okay. Can I ask a very theoretical question? How am I supposed to know that every solution of the Bobolink-Bob-Degen equation corresponds to a physical state of the system?
I must admit, my understanding of what's going on would say that it was. But can you give me an example of something that you would think that might not?
Obviously, the tricky case is the Mariana.
It's exactly this one.
And you see, in a sort of textbook BCS setup and so forth, we can write down the polyhypogenic equations. If we want to, we can even do it using a particle conserving formalism, and we can explicitly construct within a particle conserving formalism the states which correspond to the solutions to those equations.
Yeah.
In this case, can you do that? Can you explicitly, within a particle conserving representation, explicitly construct?
I would have thought you could. And
yes, I think
the answer is yes.
Analogous quantum Hall system. I'm giving that answer because that's the case where I know it's right.
I've kind of certainly explicitly thought about this, I know you guys have talked about it.
Wave function can be constructed if we don't care about the particle under conservation, but sure. Once we get the wave function, we can extract out.
But we do care about
particles. I mean, the minus particle number wave function. Also.
Right, the actual Pfaffian guy is a specific particle number.
Yeah. Well, Tony, that's why I was saying that the quantum Hall case is very similar. This particular Pfaffian Mori thing is very similar. In that case, we really can't do it. Now, I understand the differences, but it's similar enough that my guess is that you can carry over what you know to the
Has it been done?
It hasn't been done, or just a guess.
Yes.
So basically, you get a highly non-local state.
But it has to be non-local because it doesn't know where it lives, which that's the whole magic of it, because it's spread out over the whole system somehow. And if it was localized, we could perturb it and mess it up. And the whole idea is it's supposed to be protected until we bring these guys close together and then.
But the Bergman article is not crucial to get the zero mode. You can get the whole thing from one-dimensional direct equation. That doesn't answer from his question, but it's quite general. It may not be physical statement.
I sort of disagree, because even there you actually start off with the Bergman-Bolzmann equation and then transform all that.
Yeah, but you're solving the nonlinear equations. I mean, yeah. You have to start from the theory of superconductor. You have to question the theory of superconductor. But it's not. I mean, the zero mode is more general than just talking about a specific set of equation. But whether it's physical or not, which is the question Tony's asking, and I don't have a good feeling, but I do agree with you. It has to be true. In quantum Hall context, it's definitely true.
It doesn't bother. I feel I understand very well what's going on around the edge, right? Where you've got these fermionic modes, you can see exactly what's going on. You've got the quasi particles bouncing backwards and forwards and turning from electron to particle. They've got equal weight for the two of them. It's obviously Majorana. The question is whether there's an exact equal zero mode, and that depends on whether you've got periodic or anti-periodic boundary conditions. And if you put one vortex in, you've got an exact zero mode, and that makes perfect sense because you have to come in pairs. So a single vortex has got this mode. The other guy there must be another mode somewhere else, and it lives on the edge. The whole story is far too consistent, to my mind, to have some deep. I mean, that's why I spend a lot of time worrying about it. I think it has to be right.
So just to follow up on what you said, they take the
And it has to be spinless. If it's a spin-fault one, it's always a combination of a dagger up and a down. And when you take the dagger, you flip the role of the ups and downs. So in the S-wave case or a singlet case, it's not Majorana. You can tell the difference between the positive and the negative.
Yeah. So it's almost there, right?
It's got to be odd pairing in order to have the opportunity to have effectively something that's spinless and still, so you don't have this additional label.
Quantum Hall situation, quasi-particles with a fractional charge can be represented as a many particle wave function of transition of real tape.
Yes, that's right.
can you comment about this here?
I think
that's
what this discussion here was about.
Yes.
The Fapkin wave function that you write down is projected to a definite number of states. It's an ordinary wave function. It's anti-symmetric. It's made out of a pair wave function. That wave function every single one is in the same state, even though you've got a localized vortex. Right? It's not that there's something here and something there. And so once you've got this guy, you simply write down your Fapkin, but the wave function is slightly changed. Right? That's the way you're thinking.
Yes.
Right. And it just happens to have zero energy, and it's unpaired for me.
But okay, so if I'm going to comment, in the S-wave case also with a superconductor with a vortex, your function, your pairing wave function changes from the normal S-wave state because
yes.
It breaks, it doesn't have that.
Right, everything is, the pairing wave function is identical for every pair of electrons.
But it's no longer that.
It's no longer the plane waves that you had before.
So the same thing happens here. Yeah. It's more complicated because we get a longer frequency.
Yeah.
Another question. Why do people always say you have to have a half quantum vortex?
Because if you had a vortex in both spin components sitting at the same place, you would have two of these guys.
Yeah.
Those two guys could decide together to be a state that would be occupied or unoccupied.
If you apply in plane magnetism, so you have two Majorana modes, one for spin up and one for spin down.
Right.
And actually, in this case, it's very easy to induce tunneling just by applying some kind of in plane magnetic field. That will already cause some kind of analog of that.
Right. Yeah. But also, you lose the non-locality because you can make a state that's occupied or unoccupied out of those pairs.
Wait, I just want to make sure half vortex is H0 with 2 gate.
In a choice system, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That,
I
just
want to
make sure the
numbers. So it's only going around, so it only produces half the magnetic field.
I think I found it a little difficult to follow. If I take an idealized model in which there simply is no interaction between the.
If there was no interaction between the two, then everything would just double.
Right.
It's just that it would be very unstable.
But I think the whole notion of topological. Protection comes from the fact that these two Majorana modes are spatially relatively close.
Yeah, sure. But what can you have? The upstream is doing their thing and the downstream is doing their thing.
If you can rigorously separate them and not have any magnetic impurities or anything that would mix them, then it would work and you'd get twice the signal.
Yeah.
But the point is that that precision is exactly what we don't want to have, because we don't want to have precise engineering. We want the thing to be robust. And the robustness occurs. And that's the problem also with layers, as was being said yesterday. If you have n layers, then you've got n of these modes, and they can kind of get together in pairs. So it's only when you've got an odd one, you've still only got one state. You don't get n times the signal that way. So, you know.
Any other questions for Mike? Well, that's not. Mike, are you using a board?
Just a board, yeah.
Okay.
You screwed me up.
So our next speaker is Mike Friedman.
Mike, you have to put on Mike.
Oh, yes. You're talking about the one-day quantum computation?
Yes.
Okay. So he's going to talk about doing topological quantum computation by some neat method, which may or may not be easier than the method we have been talking about.
Who recognizes this date? This is the first physical reference we need. Subject.
This is the year 1588.
This is the year.
Year 1588.
Thinking of our model.
Yeah, exactly. I knew Tony would know.
So this is
when Sir Francis Drake. This is the year and the month that Sir Francis Drake vanquished the Spanish Armada that Philip II sent against England. And what's the lesson for us? is that a composition of two projections implies what you might call universal universal scaling. Okay, so you may know that you know, it's
not even valuable. Span should notice.
The span is sitting up keels. Span should be galleons. And the British, the English ships had keels, steep, deep keels, as well as sails. And that's the reason sailboats can sail into the wind. You know, there's a lot of fancy French talk about the Bernoulli effect and so on. I can assure you that second order, you know, planes fly for the reason the Wright brothers thought they would fly. You know, they're just plane on the air. And basically, if you have a projection, you know, so as in quantum mechanical measurement, when you project a vector onto an axis, of course, you'll shorten the vector somewhat, but in terms of rotation, you can rotate the vector up to 90 degrees, not quite. And if you compose two projections, and of course, 90 plus 90 is 180, you can rotate a vector by two projections up to 180 degrees, not quite. Of course, it becomes very short if you try to sail straight into the wind, it's still very slow. The projections in this case are the wind hits the sail, and the force is projected perpendicular to the sail, and then the force is projected, secondly, parallel to the keel. So, of course, now I want to talk today about work with Parsa Bondarson and Chet Nyack. In 2007, where we'll show that projections, which physically means measurement, implies some kind of, well, you might say universal quantum computing. And then I want to explain what this would mean in the present context of half vortices and psi fermions and so on.
Mike, do you want to maybe define for this audience what a universal quantum computer means?
Well, yeah, actually, that's a good idea. I mean, there it will come in flavors. So. Yeah, let me just, yeah, so I should review the way sort of the traditional view of quantum computing, the topological concept of it. So I think a lot of this is from Chen's talk, but basically quantum computing in the earliest discussions of it imagined a Hilbert space, which was a tensor product of local pieces like individual spins, something like that. So, but this is an example, not necessarily the Hilbert space. And then people thought they'd take an initial state in here and manipulate it by gates. And the gates, you know, were thought of as, for instance, Pauli matrices, or maybe controlled knot, various, you know, other discrete operations that might be applied to a small number, like one or two tensor factors. And then after a number of manipulations, you'd expect the final state. And then you do some measurement at the end to learn about this final state. and the measurement, you'd see an eigenvalue by looking at the state through some observable, and then doing statistics on the eigenvalue that you saw, you'd eventually extract information and solve, you know, whatever problem your data set was designed, your sequence of data was designed to solve. So this is sort of like the, you know, this is the coarse view of what a quantum computer is. It's a Hilbert space initialized in a certain way and acted on by unitary transformations and then measured at the end. Now, you know, the topological picture has been that the Hilbert...
But sorry, the universal, maybe everybody here knows it, but would it just be fine to even get the from one initial point in Hilbert space to any other point, you know, arbitrarily closely?
That's a traditional, yeah, that's an adequate, for some purposes, that's an adequate definition. I mean, it's not the most practical definition because it's prejudicial against bypass state, for example. I mean, what that early definition of universal does is it emphasizes the braid group representation. If you take a more practical point of view, you might say, well, the braid group is just some technique for manipulating the information in the Hilbert space. If I'm going to allow myself to use anything I can think of, maybe I can do universal computation in the five-path state or in strontium resonate by using other tricks. And that's exactly what I want to talk about today is, you know, how by using measurement we can simulate braiding. We can kind of push braiding into the background. And
but still, the universal means you kind of get from one point to any other point, isn't it?
Universal means you get any other thing that you have on to it.
Yeah. I mean, the computer science definition of universal is more practical. It's just, can you solve a certain class of problems? I mean, the Hilbert space is nice, but the ultimate thing you want to do is solve some, you know, quantum factor numbers.
I tell in the context to define things, universal basically means that if I have single qubit and two qubit gates, they're universal, meaning one computer solving a set of problems, another computer can also solve the same problems. So that's, I guess, your practical definition.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry to be answering this question of what universal is in a cagey way right at the start of the talk, but it's not that simple. I mean, if you take too strong a requirement for being universal, you may miss the whole point. You may fail to make a quantum computer out of some very lovely substance that has some little bit of not abelian statistics in it, but not a dense representation of the Braid group. But actually, what I really want to get across in these supposed 15 minutes is not the fine points. Is not the fine points of dense versus merely non-abelian, but the point that you may be able to design a computer without actually moving the excitations which define the Hilbert space through their internal degeneracies. So that's what I want to focus on. So the focus will be to simulate braiding by measurement. Now, already you should be a little bit skeptical because braiding is unitary and measurement is a projection. It already looks like we're in a little bit of trouble because how can we simulate an operator that's maximal rank with one that's lower rank? Well, the point will be we won't simulate the unitaries which a braid executes based on an arbitrary initial vector, but only on the initial vector which we have in our computer as the initial state. So there's no rank reason that this is impossible. So the simulation will be based on a primitive. And if we understand this primitive well, then we'll understand how to construct braiding. So the primitive, to give it kind of a catchy name, forced measurement. So you might think of this as measurement with a closed mind. Presume you, because of intellectual honesty, experimentalists, you go out and measure something, you take whatever you get and you write it down and you report it. It's the opposite here. We know what we want and we'll keep measuring until we get what we want.
It's known as Hendrik Schon measurement.
Okay, so the picture I'll draw is really for quite a general anionic system, but if you like, if you're focused on these half vortices, you can think of all the lines I draw like this as sigma particles, and a wiggly line like this as a fermion. So for example, you might have a trivalent vertex or an interaction like this, where you can think of time as going in either direction. So
the sigma particle and you're looking at the vortex.
Right, thank you. Half vortex. Okay, so suppose we have this situation. Suppose we have a pair that's been born out of the vacuum, two other particles with arbitrary history, and we want to measure these particles. I'm thinking of these as half vortices. Sort of the two possible measurement histories, if we measure the collective state of the pair, which we could think of as doing by fusing them and then re-separating them, this would be one possible outcome and this would be another possible outcome. Now in general there'd be various particle types that could, various possible fusion outcomes, but if you think of the simplest theory, they're just these two. There's the trivial outcome, I might put in a dashed line or not here, and the non-trivial outcome. Now, I'll diagram a measurement this way, even if I don't actually physically fuse the particles. You might just bring them close, and as Chen was suggesting, measure some differential force between the two half vortices, which is characteristic of whether their collective state is trivial or psi, and then bring them back apart. But in either case, the once you've made the measurement, you will have projected the wave function. So if you originally had a superposition, some amplitude for one channel, some amplitude for the side channel, after doing the measurement, we'll assume the measurement has been done completely, that we've succeeded in projecting. Now in a real measurement process, you form some kind of density matrix and you may not have fully projected, but we'll assume that we measure long enough. Analysis, you know, from Bondurant's thesis shows that this is an exponentially efficient process.
So,
I just want to address the theoretical question. If we can make projective measurements, how can we simulate braiding? The question of in Simon and Ruthenate or something, could you make these measurements? I don't want to touch that. Yes?
So the diagram means that if you bring it together, what is on the works at some point, this one of this.
Well, I think the way to think of it is if I draw these two lines, this is in some linear combination of these two states. And what I'm doing is I'm taking a projection into one sector or the other according to the outcome of the measurement.
Other particles
that bring them close together.
So if I take the line,
yeah. You can think that I brought them together and I either got nothing, they annihilated back into the vacuum, or they left a particle behind, and if they left a particle behind, they then split it into the original pair.
If I do the measurement right in the middle and the way one goes, I will see all my terminals and all.
No. What I'm doing is I'm looking. You can think of bringing these two particles together, and then asking what's present at this spot on the film.
Right.
Is there a particle there or not?
Yes.
And I'm assuming I can answer that question definitively. That's from point measurement, and then I split that part point. That, whether it's vacuum or a non-trivial particle, I split it back into pair of vortices.
I don't want to continue. At the point where they're merging together, if I do the measurement, I see trivial topology in trivial vacuum.
Or?
Ground state plus radial and psi. This psi presumably will even be similarly formed. This psi initially was the intra-gap state.
Well, it was concentrated, I mean, it was supported collectively by the two nearby vortices, which have now been fused.
But it's something much more abstract level. It really doesn't matter if you check out one more.
I don't understand what the question is. So everything you said sounded fine. What was the question?
May I clarify? May I answer Sasha's question? Sasha?
Can we hear the question first?
No, but it's simple. Yeah, it's what Michael Stone said in his talk. You take two vertices, you merge them, and there's a possibility, there are no vertices anymore, there's a possibility that electrons get excited above superconduction gap. That is psi. Psi is electron, real electron, not Majorana electron, you know. Electron excited above superconduction gap. So when you merge two vertices, there are two possibilities. You merge and nothing is left, your ground state, nothing excited above the gap. That's possibility number one. Or you merge them, you get one electron excited above the gap. That's possibility number two. So these are the two options.
So,
let me draw
what force measurement is and then take questions.
That's the reason of the question.
Okay. Okay, yeah, don't let me finish, but let me just start. We have four particles, and what we want to do is we want to measure and see the trivial particle here. But we have, it can be easily calculated that we have some amplitude. It's actually 50% probability of seeing the trivial particle in this situation, and 50% probability of seeing the non-trivial particle. So half the time, we'll be gratified immediately, and we'll have succeeded in doing something that might be useful for braiding, because we will have moved sort of the rightmost particle into the middle, in some sense. And motion, you could imagine, is a good way to start if you're trying to braid things. But half the time, we won't be happy, and we'll have seen a psi particle in there. What do we do then? Well, we measure in the middle, and half the time we'll see nothing, and half the time we'll see a psi. And then we go back and we measure the right two, and we'll have an independent coin toss, whether we see the trivial particle or the psi. And just so I don't run out of where I can reach on the blackboard, let's assume we're lucky this time, and we see the trivial particle. And now we will have seen this history, and we'll stop. We'll be happy with this history, because it's effectively the same as the history we hoped for at the beginning, except for this sort of tumor on the world line at the rightmost particle. But that tumor can affect the amplitude of the diagram by only an overall phase. It's not really physically relevant. So, As soon as you're satisfied that these probabilities are really independent,
the main answer is
inside. No, the expected time. You want to know how long it'll take to succeed?
Yeah.
The expected time to success is 3, and the tail, it's exponentially decreasing tail for a long time in the waiting period. The chances of having to wait n steps is exponential in n. It's very efficient. Yeah, you have a 1/2 chance of succeeding every odd coin toss. It doesn't matter. You only can succeed in odd coin tosses. Okay, so this is the concept of force measurement. And let me show you how force measurement leads to simulation of braiding. So suppose you have a line of anions, and you wish to be able to construct braiding between them. Well, for every two anions in this line, we'll meet an additional pair, which we think of as ancilla. So these are things that we, you know, maybe recently brought out of the vacuum, and we're going to use to enable ourselves to effectively braid these two particles. So this is supposed to be looked at. These particles are located kind of in a quasi one-dimensional ray in a plane, and you should think of it sort of as tipped, so you're looking at the plane more or less along its x-axis when I'm draw the time history. So I want to draw the time history on these four particles, and I want to show you how to effectively braid the leftmost with the rightmost by a sequence of three forced measurements. So the three forced measurements will be first measure these two. Then measure these two. So they'll go in front of this line. And then measure the two in the middle. Right, so, oh, let's see. I didn't
get it. Well, the two middle ones out of the vacuum? Or not? Does that
help? I'm sorry. Maybe I drew some. Let me try again. Yeah, I ended up braiding these two instead of these two, which is probably not too serious. I just forgot which no, order
to that's use. Fine. You just have to
relabel.
Just put the cup on the mill too.
Yeah. Oh, right. I'm sorry. I didn't. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Clark. I didn't diagram what I said, which is that this pair of ancilla had been recently pulled from the back. Thank you. Okay, so now what we see is that I braided the basically the leftmost line over the rightmost line. Maybe some overall phase has been changed by this kink, but again, the overall phases won't matter. And the ancilla in the middle has sort of been returned to its original status, which is also nice if I want to go on. So if I want to do another braid, I have another pair. The pair of particles in the middle is returned to its original status. So there's some inefficiency introduced because this took three steps. And each one, as David pointed out, it takes a number of steps, on the average three. So 3 times 3 is 9. So basically we did about 10. We did 10 measurements on the average to simulate a braiding. But now this means, to be completely honest, this is only half the discussion. This corresponds to just straight projective measurement, which is mathematically the easiest thing to discuss, which is simply you have a particle system, and you divide the Hilbert space into sectors according to the intermediate particle types, and you just assume you have some operation which just brutally projects onto those sectors. And in that context, you can simulate braiding, as I've shown you. A more delicate thing is if you're trying to run an interferometer. An interferometer, well, on the one hand, it does sort of project out a charge sector. I mean, that's the purpose of the interferometer. But it's actually a very complicated thing running an interferometer because you have all these quasi particles zipping through the system. And it's quite a deep analysis exactly what interferometers do. They do a little more than projection. They sever other charge lines asymptotically as you run them. And this was sort of the content of Parsa Bondarchuk's thesis and recent work with Joost Slingerland and Kirill Schengel. So I don't have time to show you details on the interferometry version of this. It's slightly different. But it turns out that the interferometry version is identical to the simple projective measurement version in the simplest case of the Ising TQFT. So whatever complications there are do not occur there. The answers come out slightly differently for the next non-abelian theory, the Fibonacci anions. But irrespective of whether you use force measurement whether you use projected measurement or interferometry, the mathematical result is that you can simulate braiding efficiently in all these anionic systems. So whatever the measurement tool you have, and whatever the system, if you can measure groups of anions in small chunks, you can simulate braiding. Turns out in the interferometry world, you have to be able to put as many as 8 anions in your interferometer, number 8, in order to keep reinitializing the system, to keep it normalization.
So, excuse me?
Yep.
The two-dimensionality is not a requirement.
Two-dimensionality? Uh-huh. Well, two-dimensionality seems to be important, so let me understand what you're thinking. Are you thinking two versus quasi-two?
Quasi one dimension compared to two dimensions. I mean, all these points are more or less.
Oh, right. These points are more or less in a linear array. They're sort of in a Hall strip, a Hall bar, or, you know, one of your layers in a layer cake of strontium ruthenate planes. It's important that the medium, the quantum mechanical medium, is two dimensional because a one dimensional wire is very unlikely to support anything like anionic charges, topological charges. There's certainly no reason to think that. So microscopically, it needs to be two-dimensional, but in terms of like the layout of the computational particles, they can be essentially linear. That's true.
So how does collective state of these 8 anions enter in this scheme now? Whether that's critical or gapped or not?
We're assuming that the, yeah, I know what you're thinking, because you're thinking about these chains of anions,
yeah.
Right?
So
we're thinking that the, for most of the computation, the anions are at their universal distances apart, many scales apart, so they're non-interacting. We're just in the ground state. And then we have whatever we need to do when we measure the collective state on a group of anions, we may have to do something non-universal at that point.
So the Hilbert space is degenerate. Is that what you're assuming?
Oh, well, Hilbert spaces are, the meaning of the Hilbert
of the 8 anions is degenerate. So all the states of these 8 anions can form a degenerate.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's crucial enough.
I think it might be important, actually.
It's not crucial because it's not true. So, it's a good approximation.
Well, I think what Simon is getting at is splittings that are larger than exponentially small. I mean, nothing is. We always in this business allow exponentially small deviations from degeneracy. But I think what Simon is worried is that if you start, you know, discovering what the collective state is by putting these anions close together and they start acting like a gapless chain or something, then maybe we'll lose some quantum information.
Yes.
But that's a detail field theory cannot include anyway. I mean, because you're not talking about any specific model. You can always assume these to be sufficiently far so that the correction.
But I kind of opened the door to this question by trying to explain how the measurement might work. You know, I said you might bring them together and see whether they were pulling. So I think Simon's question takes off on that point. Is suppose I have 8, how am I going to tell what their collective state is? Now, the, you know, the best answer in quantum Hall physics is, well, you run an interferometer around the 8, and then it's not much different than running an interferometer around 2. It just means that the edge of which you have to maintain coherence is, you know, 4 times longer. It's not ridiculous. But, you know, the previous lecture on, or the first lecture, I guess, Matthew's lecture suggested that interferometry is probably not the right way to make measurements in strontium ruthenate, right? So this idea of keeping them all far apart while measuring their collective charge might not be so good. Yes.
So if you could actually do these measurements
while keeping the part apart, then you don't even need these ancillary other vortices, right? You could, in principle, do projective measurements on the original ones itself. Is that true or is that
No, that's not true, because in order to get this idea of force measurement, we needed the ancillary particles. That was this picture, right? In other words, in order to do this braiding scene, we had to do three, what I drew as measurements here, 1, 2, 3. But each of those was shorthand for probably three other actual measurement steps that are, or three or four or five, whatever, that are conditioned on the outcome of the previous measurements.
No, but I guess one way of asking this is that suppose you consider just very far vortices and you can do arbitrary measurements, then you can think of two of them in between as being as mediating the measurements for two of them which are even farther apart. So in principle you could, right? Because it just depends. The ancillaries at the end return to their original state.
Well, I mean, you see, this wouldn't work. This force measurement scheme wouldn't work, except for the fact that these two in the middle were recently pulled out of the vacuum. So I drew this diagram, actually, which is the diagram I drew at the beginning, mistakenly.
Okay.
I would get into some trouble.
Okay.
So these ancilla are actually very useful. Now, if you really don't like the ancilla, you could reduce the total number to 2 and keep using the same ancilla, but that would be a very bad idea, because you want to be able to braid in parallel. If you have anions that are far away from each other, you don't want to have to wait while you're doing the braiding of this one to start the braiding of this.
And maybe we should might finish.
Oh, I think I'm pretty close to finished. I mean, so I think the only thing to sort of wrap up is to return to the original question that I was asked about, is this universal?
Right.
So, you know, this is the question that I necessarily hedged on. So, I think this is a very important question, actually, because, you know, the evidence that we're seeing, not just from this workshop, but the Q meeting we had last weekend, Charlie Kane gave this very interesting talk on topological insulators and proximity effect of superconductors, and also produced a mathematical reason that the Eisen-TQFT might jump out at you. So it seems like we know 3 or 4 places in condensed matter physics where the Eisen-TQFT is coming in describing ground state degeneracy of the Hilbert states. And so, and we don't really know any definitive place where these beautiful Fibonacci anions are. The other thing about the Eisen-TQFT is it contains permutations and I think controlled knot inside the braid representation. So even though it's a discrete group, it contains very many things that computer scientists would love to grab and have. You know, like just swap 2 things, that's pretty nice. Swap 2 bits. You know, in the Fibonacci TQFT, we say, oh yeah, you can swap 2 bits, you just do 10,000 braids, you know, and here's the, you know, so it's pretty cool that even though this is a discrete, non-dense representation, we can't move vectors everywhere we want, it's really nice that it has certain useful gates right in it. And people have done a lot of thinking. So there's a paper by Breve on the archive based on work of Kataya. I think this is 05. And then there's also a paper with Nyack, Walker, and myself about the same year, which give different ideas for making for bootstrapping the Eisen-TQFT to make it universal. So it doesn't make it universal in the sense of dense braid group representation. There's nothing you can do about that. The braid group representation is not dense, it can't be changed. But you can ask the more pragmatic point of view, could you trick out the quantum computer, which would solve the general problem using just the braiding you have and some other stuff. So the other stuff in the Brenner case is he proposes to use inexact gates to produce a relative phase shift, and then sharpen up these gates using the exact operations. This is called purification. And the reason, it's some kind of error correction. And the reason error correction has a bad name, at least in my view, is because error correction always, it traditionally attempts to correct errors using tools that are also full of errors. So you need extremely fine tolerances to make any progress uphill. Almost always you're sliding backhill. But the thing about having a lot of useful exact operations, like in the ISMP50, is you can work out the purification protocols using exact operations. So you're not sliding backhill while you're correcting the errors that were made in the non-universal way. So that seems like a very engineering sensible kind of approach to building a quantum computer. And then there's a completely independent approach that, which is maybe nice mathematically, because you don't end up introducing anything non-universal, but it's probably more dubious whether it can be done physically. But I think the bottom line is that the ISMP50, if it can be used robustly, could be a very viable platform for quantum computing.
What's a better idea?
Yeah,
the other idea is we call it time-tilted interferometry. So the point is, I mean, it's actually motivated by high energy, if you like. It's thinking seriously about Witten's original paper. The point is, if you have all these interferometry measurements, imagine that you can project onto charge states according to loops which are horizontal with respect to a time slice. It's a mathematical fact that if you forget that restriction that the time slice be horizontal and you're allowed to project onto charge sectors according to arbitrary loops on the boundary of the space-time, then that becomes a universal quantum computer. So we just sort of flushed that idea out and said, well, let's hypothetically imagine an interferometer where the particle path, the two arms of the interferometer, are in flux during time. So it requires, you know, repatterning the surface, creating islands and rafts and letting them drift across in real time, you know, as the interferometry is taking place. So it's pretty science fiction, I think, in terms of technology, but it was more of a way of just reconciling what we knew mathematically.
Mike, I mean, probably even without universal quantum computation, there are concepts like quantum memory and various other things which can be done extremely well with this Ising. So, you know, and they will obviously come before topological quantum computation, because we have to architect those things at a practical laboratory scale before we can do computation. And there we don't have this problem.
I agree completely.
So the fact that Ising system is showing up all over is, I think, very good for the progress.
Yeah, I mean, I think people should look very, very hard for these golden theories, you know, the level three theories. But I think they should be extremely excited if they can produce a robust Ising theory anywhere.
I mean, the Ising theory, I believe, is nuclear five powers. I mean, maybe everyone knows what
I'm sorry, I'm going to have one.
Start the Ruthenian radio.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I think that's where those letters come from, isn't it? Isn't that the...
No, I mean, some people may not know.
Oh, okay.
I have a particular question. You mentioned it, but it was not obvious to me. It's a question of efficiency that keeps on bothering me. Because mathematical proof of universality is that, you know, some problem that this can solve, something else can solve exactly the same problem. That's great. But if you take exponentially,
I mean, all these translations are actually just constant changes
in
the number of steps. I mean, the computer science requirement is usually only that there be a polynomial translation in both directions. But in these cases, the translation is quite transparent, and it's just a constant.
Okay, so doing this measurement only is not introducing any exponential law, not even polynomial law.
No, it's probably a constant like 20 or something.
Yeah, so this is this 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Other questions or comments? Yes,
Sasha. So I won't come back to mine, but basically trying to understand. I thought that the psi inside the core is protected by many reasons, because of gap and everything, and it's pretty insulated from the rest of the spectrum. By the time you bring these two bodies together, you're creating psi, that's what Mike was saying. You know, you're creating Majorana terminal state in the continuum of other states.
You don't have to do that, though. The point is, if you bring the two vortices close together, make and the states occupy, then you have to pay that energy cost. So the force law, even close, knows whether or not this guy is there. So you don't actually have to annihilate them.
It's pretty moving, but the guy.
Because there's some breaks, there's a need to be high, that energy's on the feet, accumulating in the wave function or the brain.
You do annihilate these two.
No, we don't.
Look at the diagram.
No, you can, and as Victor said, when you annihilate two vortices, you either end up with the volume of the quantum particles.
Yeah, there's no nothing. But you don't actually do it.
Yeah. Suppose I end up with the volume of quantum particles.
That's absolutely not.
Exactly. That's what I'm
doing. Right. It's rules, there's no requirement to actually annihilate the vortices. Only to find out whether that guy will appear, if you were to do that. And you can find that out before you do it by looking at this force law. So you find out that you have this law, and then that's one with the wiggly line, so you don't know that you have to keep doing more complicated, or it's not there, in which case you have.
That would be practically, I mean, there's just a practical difference between one and the other, right? I mean,
Okay, so you want the potential to bind if you do annihilate two vortices, you want the potential locally to bind the volume of quasi-particle. My question would be that if you really fully annihilate
I mean,
this psi, and wait for a long time, everything, all the ripples settle down, getting this psi flying out, and it's in continuum, and then basically the
sun protects it. But that's not what's being done here. When people draw these fusion diagrams from channels, they don't have to bring the operators actually together. You just get them close enough that when you look at them from some distance, you can see it's there. So.
So you want to make this sure the psi hangs around, so if it's in a bound state because of the normal potential you put on.
Yeah, okay.
Then
that measurement does produce e to the minus I times that extra energy times t phase.
Overall phase.
Overall phase. But yes, that's right.
That was a low
one. It's not a relative phase. So one question on here.
Yeah. I'm just looking at this picture from above as to
this picture.
Yeah, this one. But the image of the plane and where these two vortices move next to each other and these two have to be moved next to each other to do the measurements. And it seems like the paths along which you have to drag the vortices would be
they overlap.
Exactly the same as if you actually braided them. I mean, you have to be moving them in the same regions of space. One of them has to cut across, and the other one has to move here and move here.
Yeah.
And so I understand easier than just...
I was asking about the same question a different way. That it's not obvious to me that this is easier than doing interferometry. I mean, I'm just thinking of quantum Hall system, something I understand. And it's not obvious at all that for the quantum Hall system, this is an easier. I mean, that's a different point. You know,
I think that's a good point, Matt, that the advantage in the strontium-ruthenate context is less clear than in the quantum Hall, because I sort of weakened the exposition by saying, well, we'll measure by bringing them close and then back, because now we're already moving them, so why not just braid them? But the mathematical point is you really don't have to move them at all if you have an operation which can measure collective charge. So in quantum Hall, we at least have in principle idea how that might be done with interferometers. You know, maybe in strontium ruthenate, people can come up with an in principle idea for how to measure the collective state of two vortices without bringing them together. I don't know.
Okay, any other questions and or comments from Mike?
I'm still a little bit confused, but in your way of doing these force measurements, let's say, with the IPTQFT, and in the quantum Hall context, we're making these actually Euler phase measurements and so forth, can you then prepare any state in the Hilbert space as the final state? I mean, maybe you don't like that as a definition of universal. Maybe it isn't, but at least conceptually, that's simple for me to understand. You can move anywhere in the open space that you cannot.
Yeah, no, the answer is that in these sort of slightly crippled universal schemes, the Hilbert space changes because you're constantly bringing in ancilla and cleaning them out.
You know, let's allow them to be, start with the Hilbert space, including all the ancilla.
All the ancilla you're ever going to use in the computation?
Yeah.
Well, no, you won't be able to move in certain directions to stand by the ancilla.
Oh, I see. Okay, but can you leave the ancilla? If you don't care about the final state of the ancilla, you can...
You know, I don't think there's a formulation that clean. I mean, the point is, in these schemes, you don't end up using the full Hilbert space, but there's some kind of tricky subset of the Hilbert space, which you can move around freely, and that's enough.
You don't end up with kind of a direct product of the state in the Hilbert space that you're working with, one thing, and then the state of the Zora.
Yeah, I don't think it has that premium formulation, unfortunately.
Matthew, you can also think of that since they're always interested in things that computer scientists said you can do in a problem in time, you can ask how long would it take to get anywhere as an arbitrary point in the Hilbert space?
That's too long also.
Right, that would be an exponential time at the minimum just because of the volume of the Hilbert space itself. So you can only,
yeah,
you can only get the stuff, right. So you can only get the stuff that you can get to with local gigs.
Okay, I think we should thank Mike for stimulating our discussion and go on to the
Okay, so I thank the organizers for giving me this 5 minutes. I tried to be, you know, just 5 minutes. This is actually a work we did last year at UBC with Marshall Franz Stuck, two students, Hannah Weeks and Julie Rosenberg. It's already published in Nature Physics, but I'm kind of regressing that to maybe connect it with what's going on here. The motivation for that was a little different for that work. It was basically finding anions in a weakly interacting system. When we talk about these five half states, usually you should have, I mean, you definitely should have the strong interactions to stabilize that. But also a kind of a side effect or something that comes out of it is it might be a way of manipulating. Sankar Dasarma already mentioned you need to bring your AFM tip to move these vortices around. This is kind of a more concrete proposal, probably giving more control for that type of operation. So this is the simplest case where the system is actually weakly interacting. There's a 2D electron gas here assumed to be in the nu equal to 1 quantum Hall state, which is the non-interacting case. And on top of that, there's a type 2 superconductor thick enough, which I will probably clarify what it means. And then you apply your magnetic field. Oh, sorry, before that, in the superconducting field, what gives the control is basically putting an artificial array of pinning sites where superconductivity is weakened, and if you introduce any vortices would be pinned by these sites. And the control basically comes from fabricating that array. So here it's a square lattice. And that gives you a matching field. So when you apply the field, when the field flux is equal to the number of these times the superconducting flux, HC over 2E, you just fill up all the lattice with flux. And then if you're a little above or less, you get vacancies or interstitials. And the question is what happens there in the 2D electron gas. So here we applied the field. It's been quantized by the or into fluxoids by the superconducting field. And a kind of a general type argument, a Laplacian type argument, tells you that when you have an interstitial or vacancy, you're basically having an extra flux, HC over 2E, piercing the 2D electron, the plane of the 2D electron gas, and that induces an electric field, and the electric field you have this incompressible state, so there's a current and there's an accumulation of charge at the vortex, or you expel some charge from the vortex depending on whether you have a vacancy or an interstitial. And that basically gives you a half an electron charge bound at the flux. That bound state is basically this a realization of an anion. And if you do the calculation for this, the abelian phase is pi over 4. So basically, we have this, and you can move the anion around by taking the handle, which is the flux, and moving it around. Now, the same kind of... So to put this on a kind of a more firmer footing, we studied a sort of a tight binding Hamiltonian, which is a model for this system, and it could be a relevant model in certain limits. or certain 2D electron gases that are realized in diluted magnetic semiconductors. And so the model is this, but basically you have this square lattice. Through each plaquette there is a half quantum flux going through the pi flux. And you have the tight bonding model is the simple, the minimal tight bonding model that gives you the p equal to 1 Hall state. Quantum Hall state is you have nearest neighbor hopping and also next nearest neighbor hopping to break time reversal symmetry. Okay? And you put in the Pyrrhus factors in the tight bonding Hamiltonian with a properly chosen gauge. The pi flux basically, if there's no p prime, if there's no next nearest neighbor hopping, it has nodes. By introducing p prime, which breaks the time reversal symmetry, you gap out the spectrum. And here's the spectrum. Here's with some randomness in epsilon, which is the on-site potential. You get some when you fill up the lower band, you get some charge density, which is a little random there. And then you have an extra flux for your interstitial, let's say. And this just represents a choice of gauge, a string gauge, where you multiply all these lines by an extra minus one for the hopping amplitude. And that basically gives you the pi flux as you go around this, extra pi flux.
Are you fixed at filling fraction?
Yeah. So it's always at half filling.
Okay.
Yeah. So half filling on the lattice. So there is one electron per site. Half an electron per site, and there is half a flux, which is hc over 2e per site as well. So that's half filling. So
quantum hole,
and that's a mu equal to one filling factor.
Quantum hole is equal to one band filling.
That band filling is half. Yes, that's right. Okay. So in that case. So when you have this extra thing, extra interstitial, you get a bound state there, and that's a mid-gap state right at zero. And here I'm just showing the charge density wave again for the half-filled band. And you see the bound state, and that's the little wiggles come from the randomness in the epsilon that we have, the on-site potential, and here's the difference. The difference is exactly one half for the charge, and you can do even more. You can, on the lattice, you can do a kind of a Berry space calculation. So I'm taking two such interstitials, taking one around the other. Okay, and these just shows these minus signs. So there's a string that goes around, that wraps around this guy, and you can calculate the Berry space on the lattice at any, by taking a function and the limit of this function. So you take all the overlaps of your ground state functions, and when this goes around fully, that gives you the Berry space, which is twice the exchange rate. So here's the result of that.
You're on a torus, are you? I mean, you're on
a... No, this is closed band.
Plane.
Yeah, not a torus.
But you do need a model just with T and T prime finite. If you have anything else, it's not going to work. So it's another artificial model for a real system, correct?
I need to break time reversal symmetry.
I thought your tight binding model just has nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor hopping, and that's it.
Yeah, so you can add the other things. This is the minimal model.
I see. Okay, I missed that before.
Yeah. It's not specific.
This is fine tuning. There is no fine tuning.
I suppose not. Yeah, we've studied in other limits, and I think the answer is no. So this is kind of just to show you some definite results, specific results. So on the lattice, when you calculate this, you get exactly this pi by 4 gamma, and you go around. So this is just to...
What is gamma?
Gamma is the phase of this product. And the product is for the... So psi I would be the ground state when you have moved the vortex around at position I. And as I goes around and comes back, so this is for a certain lattice size, this is a full contour. You accumulate the various phase at the end.
Did you put pi points through each square?
That's right, yeah. And I have an extra one here and an extra one here.
How did that break time reversal symmetry?
No, it doesn't break time reversal symmetry if you have just nearest neighbor hopping. What I have is also next nearest neighbor hopping.
Yes.
And that sees a little less than the pi flux.
Right.
So,
pi the tubes are trying.
Yeah. Okay, so the kind of message is, if you do the same thing for a 5-half state, what you get, the charge that you get from that type of argument is 1/4, which is the charge of a quasiparticle. So presumably you're binding a quasiparticle to your extra flux, and by moving that around, you basically can do the braiding operations. And I skip these two, you all know. So this is just a back of the envelope estimate of the parameters that you might need. A is the lattice spacing for these pinning sites. So you have a square lattice, and it's for these type, like typical values of electron density, comes about maybe 1 or 200 angstroms, right? Which I think is not probably too far off reality. And there are some other parameters that you have to kind of match. There is you have to have a lattice, a vortex lattice in a superconductor. So at the magnetic field that you're realizing your quantum Hall state, that has to be above HC1 and much below HC2, so things don't move around too fast. And then there is the thickness of the superconducting film, which basically affects the penetration depth. So you want something localized. You want something. You want the penetration depth, which is not too big, and that means that the thickness should be around the bulk penetration depth, which is a few hundred or a thousand angstroms. And this is the original motivation of this work, which was strong interactions are strictly not necessary for having anions. Now this is for a billion anions, at least. And also there is an offshoot of this motivation that we studied time reversal symmetry, and actually that is also not needed. There is a kind of a more general work done by Mike Friedman here and Ketan Naik and others, a study of field theory, a double Chern-Simons field theory. And I just mentioned this because the issue of time reversal symmetry breaking is a central issue of this conference, of this workshop. And I think it's important to know, at least, or advertise this, that it is strictly not necessary, but maybe for specific materials it might be necessary. That's it.
Comments on this talk or any of the other talks? Do you have to ask a question? I was slightly confused. The vortices you were talking about, the first part of the talk, are these ordinary superconducting yes. vortices in the S-wave superconductor?
Type two.
And you seem to, if I understood you correctly, you said that you would get a fractional charge of a half E accumulated on these.
That's right. In the 2D electron gas.
Yeah. Is there any evidence for or against the occurrence of this in SGN studies, for example?
Okay. I don't think this has been. I'm not exactly sure of the experimental status of this, but.
Of having
a superconducting flux going through a 2D electron gas and seeing the charge. I guess the charge measurement would be not an easy measurement in itself, because you have to have currents and probably a shock noise measurement or something.
So I think the two issues, one is the Ted STM looked at this, and the other one, the hybrid structure didn't even.
Made? No, I don't think the structure has been made.
You do not, maybe I misunderstood something. Ordinary two-dimensional electron gas is not going to do your trick because that's a continuum. You need something that's a lattice model, correct?
No, the lattice model is just a flux. And
why are these gallium manganese arsenide? Maybe I missed something very fundamental in your talk.
That's just a system where this is kind of, theoretically, this is a limit that I'm looking at, which is the limit of very small penetration depth. So what you need is for your electron, to realize this hopping Hamiltonian to kind of be here and, tunnel, just it would be moving around by tunneling event. It's not, so you need block states, that's
In the 2D electron gas, right?
Yes, and that you can get in, yes. I hear it from.
But it's not easy to get them gallium arsenide.
Okay. But one point is that this is just a model, and I think the same sort of thing should happen even in a In a continuum.
You have in a continuum too. That's really accurate.
Yeah.
The goal is later, but as long as he has a numerical one, 24 meters.
Yeah. So that's the point. So the point general.
The in the Berry space, that way you put in all the letters?
You can do the same thing in the continuum and actually calculate the Berry space again. So, yeah. I don't know if I answered your question.
Jim, go ahead. How robust is this effect?
It depends on the gap.
No, I mean, let me ask the question the following way. So, in the integer quantum Hall effect, the basic quantum particles are not halfless flux quantum, but a singlet flux quantum, which means the following, which means that there's some excitation, which is a localized disturbance of the ground state, and everywhere else, the ground state is essentially unchanged. And that's protected by a gap. In fractional quantum Hall states, the same thing happens where you have localized disturbance of the ground state with a fractional charge, and everywhere else, the ground state is undisturbed. You put physically half of a magnetic flux quantum through an integer quantum Hall state, or an arbitrary quantum, you could bring a solenoid instead of a superconductor and just put, flux one over E, if you wish, or whatever. You won't have just a single quasi-particle in an undisturbed ground state. You'll disturb the whole system, even far away. And so, it looks like what you're doing is, rather than creating a small excitation of the ground state, it looks like you've got the ground state of a different Hamiltonian with a flux through it. So for that reason, that's the reason I'm asking how robust this is, because if exactly a flux, one half goes through the integer quantum Hall state, then maybe it's some semion. But if the flux is that minus epsilon, it seems like you get some other statistics. Because, if the supernova is not exactly on top of the two-day, some of the flux will go out through fringe fields, and you might have a little bit less than a half flux.
Right. But that's an exponential effect. So in the bulk, that's exactly. That's an exponential effect due to the edges. You have to be close to the edge, too, and that's exponential. But that's true, that if you just look at the 2D electron gas, this is not an excitation of the system,
right,
of course. But I think it's true to say that this is an excitation of the double layer system, because you have to consider the currents through the current, the supercurrents, basically. So vortices can move around, and that's really an excitation of that system.
So I just wanted to comment that there is a general model which I proposed, which I guess this actually corresponds to a particular case when pi by 2, I consider general fluxes on square ladders.
Okay, if there are no more questions and comments, let's conclude the session. Thank you.
So maybe we'll start in the afternoon at 2:15.